So in our workshop today, of course, we're looking at this topic of how to cultivate mental balance and well-being. And we're using this model of the four types of mental balance that through cultivating motivational, attentional, cognitive, and emotional balance, we can strive for this goal of well-being. And we've already seen that when we talk about well-being, of course, we're mainly talking about this state of genuine happiness as opposed to temporal happiness, which is simply our pleasurable experiences. The state of genuine happiness, of course, is a state of happiness that's not stimulus-based. It's a state of inner well-being. That normally the method to strive and cultivate this in Buddhism that is mentioned is the framework of the three higher trainings of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Of course, together with the wisdom, the compassion wing of practice. Today we're using this framework of the four types of mental balance, and we've looked first at motivational balance, which again we saw was, it says in this article from Alan Wallace, that motivational balance results from reality-based desires and intentions that are oriented towards one's own and others' happiness. And so we can see that in all these four areas of balance that we're looking at today, we can talk about three ways of imbalance: deficit, hyperactivity, and dysfunctional. And that in the motivational balance, of course, deficit means a loss of desire for happiness, hyperactivity is obsessive desires, and dysfunctional is desiring things actually not conducive to our own and others' happiness. And we looked at how to cultivate motivational balance. And that is, the first thing is we need to really cultivate these two tools of mindfulness and introspection. These are key tools in all areas of balance. Mindfulness, of course, is our ability to focus on an object without becoming distracted. And introspection is like quality control, is monitoring the states of body and mind and so forth. So by cultivating these two qualities, then the first thing we can do with motivational balance, of course, is start to reduce our obsessive desires by noticing our obsessive desires and then simply using mindfulness to focus, say, on the breathing or so forth to let go of those obsessive desires. So these two tools are very much helpful in the beginning phases of at least reducing obsessive desire. But then, of course, to overcome the dysfunctional aspect of imbalance, we really need to start to identify what are the real sources of our suffering and happiness. Because as long as we believe that the source of our happiness and suffering is out there, then of course our motivation for happiness is going to be dysfunctional in terms of desiring things that are not really conducive to our own happiness. So if we focus on these first two noble truths, the four noble truths the Buddha taught, the first one, the truth of suffering or dukkha, to really appreciate the condition we find ourselves in, then we're going to really start to stop chasing after pleasure, hoping that it's going to bring us happiness. We're going to realize that's never going to bring us any lasting, genuine happiness. And then at the deeper level, to really, through the all-pervasive dukkha, to really understand that the underlying sources of our suffering is our mental afflictions, such as anger and jealousy and craving and so forth. And that based on this, we can really appreciate that these are things that we can eliminate from our mind. And if we eliminate them, then we eliminate the suffering they produce. And through that, of course, then we can achieve the state of genuine happiness or well-being. So by reflecting on these two points, we can develop a healthy motivation for genuine happiness. And of course, that in Buddhism is often translated as using the word renunciation. So renunciation, another classic example of how Buddhist terminology can be very confusing, because that is a very poor translation of the original Sanskrit word and Tibetan word. The Sanskrit word there is nisarana, the Tibetan word ne chung. Both of those words literally mean the aspiration to emerge from. meaning the aspiration to emerge from suffering, from samsara, towards the goal of liberation from suffering, towards the goal of genuine happiness, the goal of nirvana. So by reflecting on these, then from a Buddhist perspective, then we can really start to cultivate a healthy motivation for genuine happiness. And with respect to ourself, that is what is being translated now as the word renunciation. Or a better translation would be something like the wish for liberation, the wish for liberation from suffering. And then, of course, within Buddhism, we can build on that motivation, have a more expansive motivation, and that, of course, is the motivation of bodhicitta, the aspiration of not only aspiring for genuine happiness for oneself, but also to be able to help others achieve that goal as well. So then this motivational balance, from a Buddhist perspective, if we develop a healthy motivational balance, it's really talking about developing that healthy motivation or aspiration of renunciation or the wish for liberation, understanding this, or the aspiration of bodhicitta. So this is, of course, the motivational balance. And then on that basis, as when we have developed a healthy aspiration for happiness, then we can really start to develop the other three areas of balance. And second one is attentional balance. Attentional balance, of course, in this article, it says is the ability to sustain a voluntary flow of attention with a quality of awareness that is suffused by ease, focus, and clarity. So here, of course, attentional balance is developing our attention skills, our ability to be able to focus on anything in a very stable, clear, focused way. So, of course, here also we have the three types of imbalance: deficit, hyperactivity, dysfunctional. In terms of attentional skills or balance, deficit is really talking about dullness, not being able to focus on anything in a very clear way. The technical word often mentioned here in the text is laxity. Hyperactivity here is really what's often used, the word excitation, or simply agitation and distraction. And dysfunctional means to attend to things in afflictive ways. And this dysfunctional attention often comes from the other three areas, by having imbalance in terms of motivation, emotional imbalance, and cognitive imbalance. These lead to attending to things in afflictive ways. So to deal with this, we're going to be looking at the other three areas. So here in cultivating attentional balance, we're primarily looking at overcoming the imbalances of deficit and hyperactivity, which of course is the dullness and distraction. So these are the imbalances, yeah.
Can you give an example of this attending in afflictive ways?
Well, based on what we've just done, you know, this cup of tea is really going to bring me happy, having craving and attachment for it, attending to that object with craving and attachment would be an example. Okay, so these are the imbalances. Then how to cultivate balance. So, therefore, to cultivate attentional balance, we need to overcome these two imbalances of dullness and distraction. So, this is talking about not being able to focus in a very clear way, and this is, of course, with a lot of distraction. So, what we're talking about to overcome these two imbalances is to attend in a very clear way and in a very stable way. So, therefore, the two qualities we are trying to cultivate in attentional balance is stability and clarity. So, of course, then the imbalance we're trying to overcome by developing these qualities, the imbalance of stability is distraction or agitation. And the imbalance that we're overcoming in developing clarity, of course, is dullness or laxity. But actually here, I like to add a third quality or a sort of third imbalance that we need to overcome. And I think this is probably a little bit related to the hyperactivity, on the side of hyperactivity, and that is that not only do we have this imbalance of being distracted, but in terms of hyperactivity, but we also have this sort of imbalance in our attention that now in our daily life, whenever we want to attend to something or focus on something, what do? We tense. Because we feel like our minds are so chaotic. If I don't tense, then I'm not going to be able to focus on that. So we actually have a lot of tension in our focus. And that actually leads to often a lot of agitation and distraction. And this is the way we normally attend to things in our daily life, with tension. And if we only have to focus for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we attend to things with focus in a very tense way, and we have to do that longer period of time, we often become completely exhausted and often become very agitated. So this is not really a very healthy way of focus, of attending to things. So therefore, the quality that we're actually trying to cultivate to overcome tension is not just to have a stable and clear mind, but to have also a relaxed mind. So we need to really develop a new skill, because in our daily life, when we focus, we tend to be very tense. And then when we relax, we tend to be quite dull. So we tend to oscillate between those two states, focused and tense, or relaxed and dull. So we want to develop a state where we are relaxed, but still stable and clear. So this is a new way of attending to things. And if we can really cultivate these three qualities, we will develop good attentional balance, that we'll be able to not only attend to things in a very stable and clear way, but at the same time be completely relaxed. So here, it's recommended we develop these qualities in this order, that first we work on really having a relaxed focus, then to stabilize that focus, to overcome distraction, and then work on improving the clarity of our focus. How to cultivate this balance, of course, is similar to before. We need to use those two tools of mindfulness and introspection. So again, mindfulness here, it's coming from the original Sanskrit word smriti and the Pali word sati. And as I mentioned briefly earlier, these two words, smriti or sati, literally mean to remember. So mindfulness is simply our ability to remember the object, So usually mindfulness, certainly within Buddhism, is defined as that. It's our ability to be able to hold an object without becoming distracted, without forgetting it. What we need to be aware of course, is the word mindfulness now is very popular. And a lot of the modern day mindfulness movements are using the word mindfulness in a slightly different way. So often you'll find that in some of the modern mindfulness traditions, the word mindfulness is not really defined in this way. It's more defined as often as something like a non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Very good thing. However, here, this is not exactly how this word mindfulness is used. It's simply our ability to remember the object, to hold the object without forgetting it. And often a thing, and this is going to come up a little bit more later today, I want to talk a bit more about this mindfulness, how it's being used in the modern day tradition can actually lead to a number of problems. One that I'll mention now and others I'll mention later is this idea that mindfulness is this non-judgmental awareness of whatever's arising. Again, very good thing. But then often when people hear that, and they hear that we have to be non-judgmental, they misinterpret that, or they understand that as, oh, I shouldn't respond to anything. I should accept everything. To be non-judgmental means everything's okay. I mean, this is a disaster. So non-judgmental, of course, doesn't mean accept everything. Non-judgmental means don't react to things with imbalance, with anger, hatred, aversion. This is non-judgmental. But of course, we need to evaluate things, whether something is beneficial or harmful. So non-judgmental doesn't mean, or hopefully doesn't mean, not to evaluate. Of course, we need to evaluate, but to react to things with imbalance, as we're talking about today, that, of course, is being judgmental.
May I offer
sure.
a phrase which I love and I think might be useful in this context? Talking about people who are so open-minded, their brains have fallen out.
Very good. But I've got more to talk about this today because I think it's a very important point that unfortunately brings a lot of confusion and can actually lead to a lot of difficulties if we don't understand things well. But that's all for now on mindfulness. So again, introspection here is quality control. So mindfulness, of course, in our attentional balance is we're developing mindfulness here. We're developing our ability to hold the object, to remember the object without forgetting it, without becoming distracted. But then, of course, together with that tool, we need introspection. We need to monitor that. So introspection is quality control, monitoring that mindfulness. Are we still holding the object or are we becoming imbalanced? Are we falling into agitation, distraction, or dullness? So introspection's job is to monitor that and then to correct that imbalance when we find ourselves in imbalance. Now, how to cultivate this attention skills, of course, involves strengthening mindfulness. And as we're going to see a little bit later, we can strengthen our mindfulness throughout the day. So generally, in these sorts of training, we can talk about two aspects to practice. One is, of course, here is really developing or strengthening mindfulness in meditation, sitting down, focusing on a given object, and then really working on strengthening this mindfulness and introspection in a meditative setting. Then, outside of meditation, to continue to cultivate these throughout the day. So we're going to talk a little bit about how to cultivate these throughout the day a little bit later. What I'd like to do now, of course, is talk about how do we develop and cultivate these in meditation. And that is through, again, focusing on a given object. What object should we focus on in this training? Now here, there's many possibilities, but I'll put forward three recommendations that I think can be very helpful for us and tend to be very beneficial in our modern society in general. The first and probably the most commonly recommended object for this training is the breath, the physical sensations of the breath. Certainly in most Buddhist traditions, this is the one that it tends to be most emphasized, and for a number of good reasons. And I think also for many of us in our modern society, this is an excellent choice. And the reason it's an excellent choice is a couple of reasons. One is, of course, in our modern society, we are caught up in our conceptual thinking. We're always thinking, thinking, thinking. In fact, in the meditation text, it often says something like, if you're the sort of person who is highly discursive, always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. So that, I think, accounts for just about everyone living in the modern society. We're all living in the head. We're always in this OCD mode, obsessive compulsive thinking all the time. And that creates a lot of unhappiness in our life. By focusing on the physical sensations of the breath, of course, it gets us out of our obsessive compulsive thinking, out of our conceptual mind and into the body. So that's a good start. And most of our obsessive compulsive thinking, of course, is about the past and the future. Very rarely are we in the present moment. And from a Buddhist perspective, and also modern studies are starting to show this, by living in the past and the future, it's a source of a lot of unhappiness. So by focusing on the physical sensations of breath, of course, which only happen in the present moment, we get out of our conceptual mind into the body, and we get out of the past and the future into the present moment. So I think for the vast majority of us, this is probably going to be the best object to use to develop these skills in this attention training. And with the breath practice, we can talk about at least three variations of this. The first one is sometimes called the full body breath practice. And that is simply noticing the sensations of the breath in any part of the body, any sensations associated with the breathing. So it's a very diffuse area. And that can be very helpful working with the first quality. And that is to really help us to relax. Because many of us come into this training and meditation in general, we come in from a very stressful lifestyle. Hectic, bombarded by stimulus, very active, a lot of stress, a lot of agitation. Our minds tend to be very chaotic. So when we sit down and try to focus on a given object in this training, then we do as we normally do in daily life when we want to focus. We tense. And if we bring that tension into this practice, we're going to have all sorts of difficulties. In fact, as a beginner, probably the most common reason we have difficulties in meditation is exactly that. We're too tight, we're too tense, we're simply trying too hard. So therefore, as the beginning point for this practice, we really need to emphasize cultivating this quality of relaxation. To have a very relaxed body and a relaxed mind. Because it's only on the basis of a relaxed body and relaxed mind that we're going to be able to develop our attention skills, our ability to focus in a very calm and clear way. This practice is very good for this. So if we're the sort of person that's very tight, very tense, very agitated, this could be a good place to start. Just notice breathing, sensations of breath, any part of the body, really just emphasizing relaxation, relaxation, relaxation. Together with this is a thing which Alan Wallace recommends a lot, and I do as well, is that if we, particularly in the body, have a lot of tension, or we have a lot of actual physical problems in the body, then for the meditation, adopt the posture of lying down. Don't sit upright, or if you've got body pain in the body, even in a chair, maybe you've got back problems, or you're extremely fatigued or ill or whatever, just simply lie down, flat on your back in yoga, what's called the Shavasana, the corpse posture, flat on your back, hands to the side, and just do this meditation exercise. Then we can really relax the body, really relax the mind. And this is a very good start. Then the second variation of breath practice is to focus on the area of the abdomen. Focusing on the rising and lowering of the abdomen as we breathe. Fairly large area, not that difficult to focus on. So this can be very helpful for stabilizing our attention, for developing stability. And this is emphasized in a lot of the Buddhist traditions, particularly the Theravada traditions. Then the third variation of the breath practice is to focus at the entrance of the nostrils. Now, this is a bit more challenging, and it's a very small area, a very subtle object. And because it's a very small, subtle object, it can really be helpful in improving the clarity of our attention. So those three variations are very suitable for cultivating those three qualities that we're trying to cultivate to gain attentional balance. So this is probably the one object that most people will use in this attentional balance training. Another object I think particularly suited for us in our modern society is the mind. And that is simply to look at our own mind. To simply observe our own mind and whatever is arising in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images. Develop this ability to be the observer or witness of our own mind. Many people find this more challenging than focusing on the breath. But again, I think in our modern society, this can be enormously beneficial for us. Because unfortunately, again, in our modern society, many of us tend to be the slaves of our own mind. Either our mind can be our best friend or our worst enemy. Unfortunately for many of us in our modern society, it often tends to be our worst enemy. Because what do we do is when some mental event comes up in our mind, some thought, emotion, memory, whatever comes up, we do one of two things. The most common thing we do, of course, is we identify with it, we follow it. We get caught up in our thoughts and emotions and memories, in our stories, and they often overwhelm us. And of course, every time we identify with a thought, emotion, or memory and we follow it, we're feeding it, which means the habit of this mental garbage coming up in our mind will get stronger and stronger and stronger. And then often the other thing we do is sometimes something unpleasant comes up in our mind, unpleasant thought, emotion, memory. We don't know how to deal with it. So what do? Stuff it back down, suppress it. And of course, suppressing these negative mental events doesn't deal with them, builds up a bit of a pressure cooker. And also what happens is a lot of this negative mental energy then manifests as a lot of physical illness. So I think a large number of physical illnesses that we have in our modern society are simply from suppressed mental things. And then, of course, also what we do is we feel that negative mental energy. But by suppressing it, we're sort of disowning it. So what we tend to do then is we just project it onto the people around us. For example, you know, if we have anger coming up and we don't know how to deal with it and we suppress it, then often, you know, we feel the anger in the body. It's really there. But because we're suppressing it, we're going, I'm not angry. They're the ones who are angry. Because we can feel it, but we've disowned it, so we project it. You know, no, 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 not me. Them, they're the angry ones, not me. I'm not angry. And of course, suppressing also feeds it. So whether we're expressing, whether we're identifying and following or suppressing, we're feeding. So, and we really become then the slaves of our mind. We're tormented by our own minds. And then often, unfortunately, some modern therapies understand that suppressing this negative mental events is harmful, and it is, and we tend to do it a lot. But unfortunately, as part of the solution, it's often the answer is let it out. Express it. Let it out. You know, so some anger management is like, you know, shout at a wall or hit a pillow or something. Let it out. Sure, for a short time that releases the energy. But from a Buddhist perspective, that's not a very good solution, because all we've done is we've increased our habit of getting angry. So today, okay, you may be shouting at a wall or smashing a pillow, but maybe tomorrow you're smashing someone's face. So from a Buddhist perspective, to overcome suppression, we don't need to express. And this practice can help us find that solution, that middle way. And that is to simply observe, is to simply develop our ability to be an impartial observer or witness. We don't have to fight with our mind, because if we fight with our mind, we will lose. Because fighting with our mind is like throwing petrol on the fire. It does not work. Of course, giving in to our mind also doesn't work. But they seem to be the only two options. Either we give in or we fight. Both of those, from a Buddhist perspective, is a disaster. All we need to do is step back and watch. That's all we need to do. We don't need to fight with our mind. We don't need to give in to our mind. Just do this practice. Just sit there and observe. Observe the mind and whatever's arising. Whatever thoughts, emotions, mental events, memories, whatever comes up in the mind, just watch them. Watch them arise and pass, arise and pass, arise and pass. If we do that, you'll notice a couple of things. One is, of course, every time you can manage to observe it arise and pass, you're not feeding it, which means the habit of this mental garbage coming up will get weaker and weaker and weaker. So over time, your mind will naturally become more quiet and still. So that's one effect. The other effect, of course, is by being able to observe it and not identifying or trying to suppress it, it actually has no power. Because if we look at what a thought, emotion, or memory is, it's virtually nothing. It's virtually nothing. It's not like someone with a big stick breaking our skull. I mean, it's virtually nothing. They in themselves have no power. They only have power if we give them power. And we give them power in one of two ways, either by identifying with them and following them, or trying to suppress them. If we just simply observe them, they can't do anything to harm us. So we can observe them arise and pass. So we will now then become the masters of our mind, which means instead of being the slaves, we'll be the masters. Our mind will become our best friend, which means in future, one, our mind will naturally be more quiet and still because we're not feeding the mental garbage. And secondly, because we've developed this ability to be the observer or the witness of our mind, if some strong mental event were to arise in future, we could simply be present with it, observe it, arise and pass, arise and pass. And it couldn't do anything to harm us. So therefore, this practice, even though many people find it challenging, I think is a practice that can be enormously beneficial for us in our modern society. And also with this practice, we can follow some very helpful advice from great Indian Buddhist master Shantideva from the 8th century. And he says, no matter how difficult something seems, everything with practice becomes easy. And it's true. So maybe now you find it very difficult, if not impossible, to observe your own mind. If you simply patiently practice, then over time it will become easy and we'll become the masters of our mind. So there was a question.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to ask in that process, say, for example, what Shantideva was saying about practice, is there a natural progression from doing that meditation guided to silence, or is it just a variable, what works for the individual?
Yeah. So with any sort of meditative practice, then not only are we talking about the actual meditation, but of course we need to prepare ourselves well in terms of posture and preparing our mind and so forth. And then in terms of the actual meditation, then as a beginner, of course, it's very helpful to get very clear instructions on what to do. And then sometimes some of these, although this type of training, the instructions tend to be fairly simple, some other types of meditation are more sort of analytical in nature, and you have to go through certain steps. They may be hard to remember what to do. So then what you can do, of course, is you can get a recording of the guided meditation and use that for some time till you're familiar with it, and then use it, then you know what the steps are. But also here, in the initial stages, it could be useful to listen to a recording a number of times to become familiar with it. But then in general, I think it's better to let go of the recordings, because often what happens then is we become very lazy. And then it becomes quite mechanical, you know. And then we sort of delude ourselves into thinking we've done the meditation, where we're barely even listening to the instructions. So I think, therefore, at some point, it's good to let go and just do it yourself. But then also, what can be helpful is that sometimes, if we just do it ourselves, it also can become a bit stale, or you may actually forget what to do. And then it's good to sometimes maybe go back in future to listen again to make sure we've got the right technique. And also maybe if we're listening to someone's voice, they can maybe be a little bit more inspirational as well. So I think that's sort of a good approach. And then one more object that I think can be very helpful, again, in our modern society, is no object. And this is sometimes called awareness of awareness. What this practice is about is, in the two previous practices of the breath and the mind, we have a distinct sense of me observing the sensations of the breath, or me observing my mind and thoughts and emotions. Whereas the third practice here is there's no sort of distinct sense of being a separate observer observing something. Because in the third practice, we are simply resting in the mind itself, resting in the experience of awareness itself. It's simply being aware of being aware. And again, that's something that many of us haven't really trained in. Again, it goes back to what we looked at in the previous section, this idea of action addiction. We're always addicted to doing something, you know, like that experiment with the shock. You know, we can't even bear to sit with ourselves for 5 or 10 minutes and not do anything. We have to do something. And so many people find this very challenging, not because it's complicated. Actually, it's so simple. I mean, we're virtually doing nothing in this meditation. It's so simple. But that's why people find it difficult, because it means do nothing. It means don't do anything, just be. Just be present, just be aware of being aware. That's all we got to do. It's so, so simple, and that's why people find it very difficult, because we always want to do something. So in this practice, it's not that dualistic sense. It's simply being aware of being aware. And the big advantage with this, or in the number of big advantages with this practice, one is that it helps us to overcome this addiction of doing. You know, I have to do something, do something. We can simply be present. We can just be. And of course, when we do, our mind usually contracts around whatever's in front of us. So often our mind becomes very small and constricted, and we seem to be overwhelmed by everything around us. Whereas if we can do this practice and get in the habit of just being present, being aware of being aware, if we're in that practice, what you will notice is the mind or the awareness is not small and constricted. It's completely open, spacious, limitless, and completely still. So if we can get into this practice of simply resting in awareness, being aware of being aware, not only are we developing a relaxed, stable and clear mind, but we are also developing the ability to rest in that open, spacious stillness. And if we can do that in meditation, we can bring that into daily life, meaning in daily life, in the midst of all these bombarding appearances, we can be in that very still, open, spacious state. So that's going to be very, very helpful in daily life. And again, many people find this very challenging, but not because it's complicated, because actually it's too simple. Too simple. It's basically doing nothing. And that's why people find it difficult. People, we don't know how to just be. We always want to do something. But again, enormous benefits. So these are three objects that Alan Wallace really recommends a lot, and I also feel that they bring a lot of benefit to us in our modern society. Any questions about any of those objects?
Can I, again, make an offer?
Sure.
Because I think it's a useful phrase that no object, I think I've heard expressed as, don't just do something, sit there.
That's right, something like that. Well, it's more than just sitting there. I mean, we can sit there and space out.
As a short.
That's right.
How similar is the third type of meditation to Zazen?
I'm not that familiar with Zazen. What we need to distinguish here is that there is also other practices sometimes called open presence, or open awareness or something. That's not this. Because in this practice, we're not interested in any appearances. So in this practice, of course, if you sit and just be aware of being aware, of course, thoughts, emotions, memories will appear, will rise in your meditation. But in this practice, we're not paying any attention to any appearance. So whatever's arising, we're not trying to block, but we're just not interested. Something similar to this is resting in that and be aware of whatever is arising. Open presence, open awareness, given different names. So that's not this practice. I mean, that's how you could bring this practice into daily life, is to be in that open awareness state and then be aware of everything. But actually in this training, in the actual meditation, we're not paying attention to any appearances at all. Consciously shutting down, or
not consciously? No. Just letting go, almost.
And right.
Down that.
Yeah. I mean, what you will find in any of these trainings, as we're developing mindfulness and introspection, as we really get more developed, these qualities or tools, actually, what happens is in the meditation, while you're in meditation, your sense faculties shut down. You're not consciously trying to shut them down, but they shut down. Yeah. So in the high levels of practice, whatever you're focusing on, you have no sensory awareness active. Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
But that's just a side effect of the nature of attention training, not an effect of a specific practice. Yeah.
They get, I think, one step further when they become almost unconscious of what's going on themselves, but they can come up. So I think the mind shuts down to such an extent that they're practically unaware of anything, really.
We have to be careful. We're not shutting down the mind. I mean, in these practices, as we progress, the mind becomes more clear, more alert.
Yeah.
There are certain practices where you shutting down everything. This is not really that. what I'm saying is in these practices, the mind will become more alert, more aware. Yeah. But because of that, the other aspects of the mind, like the sensory faculties, because of that, will go quiet. Mm. So there's, we're not, so when we're in the high levels of this practice, the mind becomes crystal clear.
Yeah.
Crystal clear.
I think the Zazen thing is to have the mind, to have the clarity but not conscious of it, so that they can, say martial arts, can react with clarity and...
Sure. Maybe you're talking about the conceptual mind.
Yeah.
So also here, of course, as we develop higher levels, the conceptual mind also becomes very quiet. So maybe that's what you're talking about, shutting down the conceptual mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. What I'd like to do now then is to do a little attention training, little meditation, developing this attention skills through mindfulness and introspection, focusing on the abdomen, which is very much recommended in many of the Buddhist traditions. And one point I'd like to mention before we start the meditation is that with the meditation, of course, it's important to prepare ourselves well for the meditation, because often what people do when they meditate, they sit down, jump down, start meditating, and then often things don't go very well because they're not really prepared physically or mentally. So in this meditation, we're going to go through a little bit of preparing ourselves physically and mentally, and then we're going to move into a little bit of this training, strengthening our mindfulness and introspection using the abdomen as the object. So the abdomen, again, is simply the rising and lowering of the abdomen and sensations of that as we're breathing. Okay, so let's do that short meditation and then we'll break for lunch. So as always, we begin by preparing the body. And the two most important things with the body, the posture, is to keep the back nice and straight and allow the body to be completely relaxed, completely at ease. So again, allowing your awareness to descend into the body. Simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And also keeping the body as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement or fidgeting. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And then preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. So not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you can most easily notice any sensations associated with the breathing. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. focusing on the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. And maintain an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. Maintaining that mindfulness throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. And using introspection to monitor that mindfulness. Noticing if you're getting caught up in either imbalance of dullness or distraction. And if you notice that you've become distracted, then no need to get upset. And simply the first thing to do is simply relax. Then release the distraction and very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return. Each time you notice that you've become distracted. or if you've noticed that you're becoming dull or spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus on the breath. If you're finding that you're constantly becoming distracted, then you might like to experiment with counting the breath as a way of helping to stabilize the mind. So at the end of the in-breath, mentally note one, and then focus on the sensations of the breath during the following out-breath and following in-breath, and then mentally note two. In this way, you can count from 1 up to 10 and go back to 1 again. And if at any time you lose the count, simply go back to 1. So you might like to experiment with counting the breath now and see if that helps to stabilize your mind, your attention. let's break for lunch and come back at 2:15. And we'll talk about cognitive and emotional balance this afternoon.